Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear some in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Cardiff Garcia. I'm an economics podcaster and co-founder of Bizarre Audio. Today's episode is being recorded on September 26th, 2022. Before we get started, we just want to say thanks to all of you who've rated and reviewed the show in your podcast apps. We really appreciate that, and we'd love for more of you to do the same because we love hearing from listeners. Also, I just want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice, and it is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. I'm joined, as always, by co-host, CEO of Fundrise, Ben Miller. Ben, we have to provide information and entertainment on this show. How do you feel about that?
You take the entertainment.
All right. Ben, you've prepared something of a treat for our listeners. We are going to do a kind of revisitation or just a recap, a restating of something that we did in our very first episode together all the way back in February. And that is scenario planning. Let's tell our listeners what scenario planning is again, just to remind them, and then we'll jump right into it.
So back in February, we were looking at the future, looking at the year, and saying, what do we think is going to happen? And there's a framework that we use at the company I learned years ago called scenario planning. It was invented by Peter Schwartz. Basically, is you need to structure your thinking because a lot of times you're planning for the future, but it's not in an organized, structured way. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be as systematic, as analytical, and a lot of cognitive bias will sneak into your planning. And that's usually what causes a lot of bad decisions, cognitive bias. And the framework is simple. Scenario one is usually an optimistic scenario. And usually optimistic scenario is more of the same. These days, maybe not so much, but that's usually the framework. So these days, maybe you'd hope it gets better. Scenario two is it gets worse, pessimistic scenario. Scenario three is a surprise scenario, unexpected scenario. So that's the structure that we try to use for scenario planning.
Yeah, I remember this as a really useful intellectual exercise as well, because obviously everybody needs to have some kind of a forecast in mind when they're making decisions. But it doesn't mean that you have to limit yourself to just one forecast because so many different things are contingent. And so thinking through all the different possibilities is really helpful. So we did this exercise where we took scenario one, more of the same, which, like you said, by default, that is usually the optimistic scenario because over time, the economy tends to grow and risk assets tend to go up in value. Right now, maybe not so much, but then scenario two would be the kind of worst case scenario. So if everything goes wrong, what does the world look like? And then scenario three is just trying to think through something really hard, which is what potentially could be completely out of the blue, unexpected, who the heck knows? And I think it's worth revisiting where we were back then in February when we recorded that show. So back then, interest rates still at zero. The Fed had not started its hiking cycle, all right? Still at zero, but inflation was already spiking. And there was a very pessimistic outlook for the Ukraine-Russia war. Thinking was at the time that Russia really had the upper hand and that it might have been just a matter of time before it would be raising its flags up on Kyiv. But there was a ton of uncertainty there.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And I think the strong market expectation was that inflation would be transitory.
Yes, that word again.
That was what the Fed was saying. That's what the credit markets were forecasting. And the big assumption was going to be that, okay, inflation was high right now, but it would come down pretty soon thereafter. And wasn't necessarily that big a deal because it would come and go like the wind. It was not something we were imagining would be permanent in most market forecasts.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of rationales for why people thought that inflation would be transitory at the time. One was that there were a lot of inflationary items that seemed to be very pandemic related, that they were related to the clogging of global supply chains, and that over time, that would ease up. And so we'd have this supply side unblocking, and that would lead to more production, and that means less inflation. The other was that we had a couple of years of very aggressive fiscal and monetary policy, but especially fiscal policy, and that the stimulus from that fiscal policy was starting to unwind, that it had peaked by that point, and that the fiscal impulse coming into the new year would be a lot weaker. But worth noting that, again, interest rates back then were still unbelievably low, both historically and relative to where inflation was at the time. And so there was some fear that the Fed might be behind the curve, but because the thought was that inflation was transitory, that the Fed didn't really need to act very much. And so we talked through some of those scenarios, that sort of more of the same scenario where inflation remains high, elevated, and doesn't come down, but the Fed also doesn't act quite as fast as maybe it ended up acting. But the scenario two is the one that I remember the most because you laid out some really troubling potential scenarios there. The one I remember especially was the concerns about something breaking in financial markets because of all the uncertainty and because of all these contradictory forces. What else should we update our listeners on in terms of where we were back then and the specifics that we ran through in terms of those scenarios?
I think we also discussed the possibility of Ukraine escalating, potentially going nuclear. And so the question was inflation transitory, cyclical, short-term, or was it permanent, structural, long-term? And we ran different scenarios. And we also looked at Ukraine, different scenarios, right? That it would be a long grind, that it would escalate in something catastrophic or something unexpected would happen. The same framework applied to Ukraine. So I think we can look back now and call it inflation was not transitory.
Yeah.
It stayed higher for longer than basically anybody in the market expected. Even now, I think there's a lot of the same dynamic, which is there's still an expectation it comes down soon, but it's going to be harder and slower than what everybody had been expecting. So higher for longer. And Ukraine, how would you call that one, Cardiff?
Surprising. Okay. Relative to expectations, you know, in terms of its effect on the rest of the world, I think it's been about as bad as we'd expected from an economic standpoint, from the standpoint of keeping energy and food prices really high and without any kind of relief in sight. This was because Russia turned off the taps to the natural gas that it was providing to Europe. This was because the war, of course, has been protracted. And so that has made food prices in particular quite elevated because both parts of Russia and especially Ukraine provide a lot of the world's wheat. So it's just led to very high grocery and restaurant prices and extremely high energy prices all across the world, not just in Europe, because of course, when Europe loses access to Russian provided supplies of energy, it ends up sourcing them from elsewhere, including from the United States. And so that keeps prices elevated everywhere. And so in terms of the economic impact, it's been quite bad. I think this falls into, frankly, scenario two, like the worst case scenario. I think it's somewhat heartening that Ukraine did not get just completely run over and colonized by the Russians, and that in fact, it seems to have turned the tide of the war. So I want to make sure that we're separating those two things, the economic effects and what we see in terms of the values that we all hold dear. That's something of a personal commentary, but I actually think it's important to include that. What about you? What do you think about Russia, Ukraine?
I can't believe how successful they've been on the ground to see them really just punch way above their weight and break through. I've been worried since the beginning that Putin had made a one-way bet, and that means that he will only escalate. He'll never back down. And so that might lead to tactical nuclear weapons on the ground in the battlefield in Ukraine. It just seems to me that there's no way that Putin can do anything but double down.
And I've been also heartened, I think, to see that the alliance of Western European countries and the U.S. and some other countries throughout the world have kind of held their ground on this, even despite the threat of what might happen with Europe facing a potentially terrible winter and energy prices sky high. They've really quite held their ground firmly on the sanctions and on their support for Ukraine, at least so far. And of course, as we've said, that does have some economic consequences, which have been tough. And I don't want to either minimize those or understate just how surprising and how, as you described it, how heartening it's been that Ukraine has held fast and has protected its sovereignty. I want to add, by the way, one other thing that we haven't mentioned here, which I think is also a sign of how the world has changed. Back when we spoke in February, it was still in the middle of some variants developing of the coronavirus and which were sweeping the country. And there was a risk, and I think this fell into scenario two, that an even newer and potentially more lethal variant might also start sweeping the country. That has not happened. I think that wave from earlier this year was terrible, but not as many people died as before because of the vaccinations. And also, we're not thinking about it quite as much anymore either. It's still definitely there. It still matters. And something new could happen. But that also is a sign of how the world is different now from back in February.
Right. There's been actually a lot of positive developments because you haven't seen U.S. economy break. It's actually been surprisingly strong. And what's really become, I think, the unexpected driver is geopolitical dynamics. So we can get into that as we move to the next phase, which is redefining our current scenarios. What would we revisit in the scenarios if we were to do them again today? It seems like scenario one is if trying to be optimistic that inflation does come down. And I think the most optimistic, which is apparently the Federal Reserve, is that it comes down to close to 2% inflation rate. That would be the expectation of the Fed. And that happens over, let's say, 18 to 24 months. And we start to see it come down soon and it falls steadily through the next 18 months, 24 months. Do you have any edits to that scenario?
I mean, if scenario one is more of the same, I would actually say that scenario one would be something closer to we end up with higher than 2% inflation for a couple of years, but not at the level where we're at now, partly because we've seen some softening of inflation month to month over the last 3 months. But even then, it doesn't look like getting back down to 2% in the next like 12 to 24 months is a more of the same scenario. That is the optimistic scenario, but I think more of the same would get us something in the realm of 4 to 6% inflation.
Yeah. I mean, that's my expectation as well. It comes down to 4 to 5%, but it can't fall more than that considering the world's structural issues. So that's scenario one. Scenario two is that during that tightening period, something breaks, and that could be economic, it could be geopolitical, but that basically in the process of trying to bring down inflation, the system is not resilient enough to withstand that. That would be scenario two, and scenario three would be some kind of surprise. I have a couple. Obviously, one surprise could be positive or negative in Ukraine. There's a bunch of scenarios there that I think really could surprise the way things play out. And then I have a couple other ones related to China that I thought we might get into.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll give my quick summary of where my scenarios one, two, and three are as well. So for scenario one, the confusion continues. And by that, I mean that there's the expectation of slower growth and possibly even tipping into a recession because the Fed has been so aggressive recently and because economic growth itself has slowed considerably in the first couple of quarters of the year. But the labor market has stayed quite strong. We're still creating a lot of jobs, and it's hard to know what to make of it. So I'm going to call scenario one for me, confusion reigns. Contradictions continue. Something like that. Okay.
Good one.
Scenario two is that the labor market essentially follows the economy off a cliff. So scenario two being the worst case scenario, it's that the Fed deliberately does continue to engineer not just a slowdown in growth, but if necessary, a big recession. So yeah, inflation might come down in that scenario, but it's at the cost of losing millions and millions of jobs. And scenario three, the unexpected, there's a bunch of different ways you could go with this, a new variant and so forth, nuclear war. I don't know if that falls under scenario two or scenario three. Here's mine, which is that the congressional elections lead to a surprising outcome, which itself leads to the policymaking environment being different from what we expect right now. So, for example, if the Democrats surprisingly sweep the congressional elections, which increasingly does look like a possibility, right, that you end up getting some other kind of fiscal policy measure that either spurs economic growth or possibly exacerbates the downturn. And I don't know what that would look like. That's why it's under scenario three. But I'm watching politics for my scenario three.
I think the essence of the question is an inflation forecast. So if inflation comes down more naturally, it leads to one conclusion. Inflation doesn't come down more naturally, then it has another conclusion, which requires escalation from the Fed, et cetera. So
wait, stay with me on this point, though, for a minute. You're essentially saying that inflation and how it moves is what's going to dictate all the variables that surround it, as opposed to targeting, I don't know, economic growth specifically or the labor market or the exit from a pandemic scenario. You're saying that inflation and what it does is what's going to end up dictating everything else. Is that right? Because that's a significant thing to say.
That's my view. Although from an investment point of view, it's really the Fed that dictates returns.
Okay.
And so if you follow the Fed, you can't fight the Fed. And so the Fed went restrictive around the time we talked in February. And that ever since then, all asset prices have been falling.
Yep.
And basically, I think they'll fall as long as the Fed is restrictive. And they will flip once the Fed has decided that they can stop raising rates and let them fall again. It's kind of a depressing takeaway I've had over the 20 plus years of investing is that the Fed dictates asset prices. And so inflation is what will be the driver of the Fed's decisions. And so the inflation is sort of the leading indicator and the Fed is the lagging indicator.
I think that's right. If you follow the speeches given by Jerome Powell and some of the other members of the FOMC, they have become almost entirely fixated on inflation and essentially saying that if there's some collateral damage in the labor market because of their efforts to bring inflation down, that is a necessary price that they are willing to pay now. I also just want to say something that others have also mentioned, but which I still think is quite striking, which is that a 300 basis point rise in the targeted federal funds rate in the last 6 months is the fastest rate hiking cycle in 4+ decades. And I don't think we should forget that. I think that is quite stunning. And it shows both that the Fed is willing to act now and that things can change quickly relative to what we thought. I think if you and I were to have given a forecast for where the federal funds rate would be now back in February, I don't think either of us would have said that it would have been north of 3%. But here we are.
And for people who are borrowing, whether for real estate, for a company, you're talking about borrowing at a 6.5% and probably 7% interest rate next year.
Yep.
Rather than a year ago, you're borrowing at 2-3%.
Mortgage rates north of 6%. Do you have that in your forecast anywhere? Anybody that you talk to at Fundrise or elsewhere, were real estate folks thinking that was even a possibility at the start of the year?
I think we thought it was a possibility and we had been preparing for this for some time, but
okay.
Definitely I was on the bear side of this, which is consistent. And so we've been trying to prepare for what we thought was going to be higher for longer. That's been our view. I think it's been somewhat explicit, but maybe not as explicit as I need to be for people to realize like how bearish we were.
And given that restatement of where we are, Ben, you've also prepared a list of drivers of inflation that you wanted to go through and that we're going to kind of go through together. And I want to be clear, I have not seen this list. So some of this is going to be like an improv comedy show. So yeah, 10 drivers of inflation from Ben Miller. Let's go. Yeah, I can't wait.
Okay. In no particular order here, let's just start with sort of goods and manufacturing.
Okay.
Right. As you look into the near term, would you say that what's happening with goods and manufacturing are largely tipping to scenario one or scenario two?
It's a good question. And all throughout the recovery from the pandemic, I've been expecting for spending patterns to return back to where they were before the pandemic. In other words, switching away from goods relatively back into services, which doesn't mean that goods spending is just going to completely collapse, of course, because if the economy is doing well and people just have a lot of money to spend, things would be okay. So I would say that this would probably fall closer to a scenario two, where if the economy starts to go south, I think goods spending is something that people would sacrifice, partly because they've spent so much on goods in the last couple of years, especially durable goods, and partly also because it's an easier thing to cut. What do you think?
So I think that this ends up tipping to scenario one, which it brings down inflation.
Okay.
And the leading indicators are lumber and copper, which both have fallen significantly. Inventories are up. And so I think that we're not yet seeing it in the economy. But I think within a few months, manufacturing and price of goods will really start to come down. And that will be an early indicator that inflation is starting to get under control. At the moment, though, in our day-to-day, it's not yet totally, you know, in line. We're still seeing our builders have shortages. The shortages have moved to new things. It used to be a refrigerator. Now it's decking, windows, electrical equipment, transformers, wall boards. So I think we're seeing early indicators that goods and manufacturing are starting to soften. So I think it shifts to scenario one in the next few months.
Yeah, I can roll with that. When I say scenario two there, which is the pessimistic scenario, I was thinking more of, I guess, consumption items. I think of copper and lumber certainly as like intermediate inputs into things. I worry about manufacturing from the standpoint of the dollar remaining and continuing to be quite strong relative to the rest of the world, which tends to be bad for the manufacturing sector historically. So we'll see. I have a somewhat pessimistic view of what will happen with goods generally and goods spending in particular.
The interesting thing is that enough pessimism to bring inflation down, but not enough to break the system. Some pessimism is necessary to basically get the market normalized. So it's really a question of whether if this breaks to one or two. But I'm saying that I think it's going to end up not being the source of the break.
A breakage. Gotcha.
A breakage. Okay. It ends up being mostly necessary to bring inflation down. But you did raise the next one on my list, which was foreign exchange.
Yeah.
Right? The dollar. So to summarize, the dollar has rallied way more than anybody expected. This was a total surprise, I think, that to see dollar go. We actually had a Japanese investment firm into some of our products. So they were investing in our real estate. And the yen went from 106 yen per dollar, which is when they invested, to 140 yen per dollar. So it rallied 30-some percent. And actually, I called them up. I said, you guys should like just take your winnings. This is really unnatural.
Yeah. FX is an interesting one because I think from the standpoint of bringing down inflation domestically, I guess it would fall into scenario one, a kind of useful source of falling inflation, fairly benign. Internationally, I think it could fall into scenario two. You could have a lot of recurring financial crises, especially in emerging markets, some of which still borrow in dollar terms, not like the 90s when this was really quite rampant, but still is a danger every time the Fed tightens monetary policy aggressively. There is a fallout throughout the emerging economies. And so I worry about scenario two internationally. And of course, that can redound back to the U.S., but that's, I'd split the difference in FX between one and two.
I would say my view, FX or foreign exchange ends up being scenario two.
Okay.
In that it's causing a lot of world instability. It's causing the cost of goods, which are usually denominated in dollars, to be expensive for Europe, expensive for emerging markets, and the cost of borrowing, which are usually denominated in dollars, to go up. So that's negative. It causes more likely breakage in the world. And then in terms of inflation, so far inflation has been 8% plus, and the dollar has been rallying. So that should have brought inflation down because you buy something abroad and you buy in strong dollar, basically you're getting it cheap. But we had a super strong dollar and high inflation. So likely at some point that dollar starts to fall again. And yeah. So like almost the success of bringing down inflation will lower interest rates, which will then lower the dollar, which will then bring inflation back to the U.S. as basically imports get more expensive with a weaker dollar. So I think where the dollar has sort of been an all-around negative because it's trapping us with inflation and hurting foreign markets.
I want to make a distinction here that I think is important to note about what's been happening the last few months. So you noted there that inflation is still at above 8%. That is, of course, the year-on-year number, which is what I think most people follow. That number, though, is a little bit vulnerable to base effects, right? So you can have a ton of price hikes earlier in the year that will still be showing up now as very high inflation year over year. But if you just annualize what inflation has been doing in the last few months, it is weaker than that. And so I think that that strong dollar will still have that fundamental effect of keeping at least a lid on inflation in the near term. The thing that you just described about like the knock-on effects in like a year, possibly longer than that, like that is certainly possible. I don't rule that out. I'm thinking more in the sense of what's happening now and maybe a year out. I think the strong dollar will still have that benign effect at home. But like you said, with the possibility of breaking things abroad, and you never know what the effect of that could be back on the U.S. Yeah.
All right. It was perfect. You teed me up perfectly for another one. So housing.
Okay.
So housing has been highly inflationary. It's something that, you know, Fundrise, we know something about because we have 20,000 residential units in our portfolio. And so we've been seeing rents double digit, 12, 15, even we were saying in Tampa, 25% rent growth. And so it's been a huge driver. And so why it's a base effect for inflation for rental housing is that people don't all move out of the apartment building at the same time.
Right.
Leases turn over, and as leases turn over, they reset to market. And so it takes a long time for every lease in the building to reset to market. And so rental housing is going to drive inflation even after rents have stopped moving. because as the old leases reset to market, it shows up as inflation, but it's a super lagging indicator.
Yeah, this has been a big concern of mine as well, which is that, as you noted, it's not like, you know, you just have this one-time effect on rental inflation where in the same exact month every year, everybody resets to their new lease. It's an ongoing thing. And not everybody's lease is reset. Some people don't even reset once a year. Sometimes they're on 2-year or even 3-year leases. And so I'll defer on this one to you. You're the real estate guy. So, but everything I've seen so far suggests that rents are going to continue hammering people. Yeah. Do you have this under scenario 2, by the way? Or is this
No, so I have it under scenario 1. I think that actually everybody's looking in the rearview mirror and don't know it. And so in our portfolio, rents have really started to come back to normal in the last 60 days. They've gone from 12% to 8% to 6% to 4%. Like I'm talking about real time. Like these numbers are not being reported to anybody yet because it's September 26th and people start renewing their leases for October in September. And so I see housing as actually both for rent and for sale, right? I mean, every headline says for sale housing prices coming down, yet none of that's in the data yet, in the inflation data. I don't know how far lagging CPI is on real data on the ground. Sometimes it surprises me how slow the government pipeline of data is, but I think housing is going to come down a bunch from a driver of inflation and become an actual positive contributor to sort of letting the Fed stop hiking rates.
And I hope you're right. And it's certainly quite possible. I don't rule it out. Just in terms of like where it is now, I do worry that this is going to continue to be a big driver of inflation. But as you said, it's interesting to consider the possibility that the headline inflation readings will be higher than what's actually happening on the ground, possibly for as long as 6 months or a year even, because of that base effect that you described
right, when
we first started talking about that, which is a little bit unfortunate because you could imagine a scenario where inflation really is coming down quite a bit. And the decline in inflation will be sort of understated because of those base effects, which you'll be seeing inside of Fundrise, but the rest of the world won't know about because when they look at CPI or whatever, it'll still be inflated. I'd have to think a little bit more about like that kind of trade-off, but I think that's a real possibility.
That's almost more of the same because the Fed was very slow to raise rates. They were super behind the curve. And then you say, okay, if that continues, which often institutions maintain a certain type of pattern of behavior. And so then the Fed ends up keeping rates higher for too long and doing more damage than they mean to because the data they have is so lagging and their decision-making so slow.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a good segue to your next one because I don't actually know what it is. And I suspect that I didn't accidentally trigger it this time. So what comes next?
So let's do labor.
Okay.
I think I saw this quote, in a service economy, labor is the new oil, right? So 70% of our economy is labor. Back in the 70s, right, I think that services were much less percentage of the economy.
Yeah.
And oil had a much bigger effect on prices. So if labor is a shortage, which we've seen so far, when you look forward into scenario 1 or 2, how do you think about it affecting inflation?
This one's complicated, and it's maybe the most difficult to discern. For one thing, the economy continues to grow, continues to create quite a few, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs each month. It has slowed its pace of jobs growth since earlier this year, but I think it's still a lot healthier than a lot of people had anticipated relative to the slowdown in overall economic growth and certainly relative to how quickly the Fed has acted in terms of raising rates. But here's the thing is that wage growth has also started to weaken a little bit. And so if you look at just wage growth, you could say, well, eventually that'll pass through into weaker inflation as well. A lot of people sometimes act as if, well, if you throw a lot of people out of work, that would reduce inflation. But that's not actually clear to me. It assumes that the people that lose their jobs weren't creating enough to sort of justify their salaries before then. But if they were justifying their salaries, if they were producing enough, then it means that like it really should have a muted effect on inflation because on the one hand, yes, you have the money that they're making, which contributes to demand, but you also have the products that they're producing, which contributes to supply. And it's not actually clear one way or the other how that would work. So in terms of the labor market, I do worry that this is going to fall into a scenario two situation where a lot of people are going to start losing their jobs because the Fed has been so aggressive. And because I suspect the Fed might end up overshooting relative to what it needs to do in terms of raising rates to get inflation to start moving back down. So that's my concern. But I guess I don't know is the right answer. What do you think about where the labor market is and what's happening with inflation?
Well, you said something I hadn't really thought about. If you take somebody and you throw them out of work, obviously they call it demand destruction, right? There's less demand because a person's out of work in the economy, but also it just might destroy supply.
Yeah.
So you basically shift the supply curve and you shift this demand curve. So that may not actually cause inflation to fall. That's an interesting point. The points I was thinking about are the first were structural. So you have three structural dynamics that are causing labor to be in shortage. And one is that since 2016, the country has stopped immigration or really, really cut it down. And so I've seen numbers like 2 million less people in the country than there would have been. And those 2 million would have been service jobs and construction jobs. And so without those 2 million, we've seen a lot of demand for labor and nobody to fill it. And I think that's part of the reason why that there's a labor shortage. And you can't really replace those people with like a higher interest rates. It's not a one-for-one trade. And I think that's a structural problem. Two is we have an aging population. And so as baby boomers retired, and they retired in force during the pandemic, and I think you'll continue to see high rates of retirement because they're turning 65 fast. I mean, you look at the numbers, 15 years ago, something like 12.5% of the country was over 65. By end of this decade, 25% or 23% of the country will be over 65. With those people leaving the workforce, demographically, that means there's less labor.
Yeah.
So that's a really complicated effect on the economy. And then lastly, there's some interesting cultural effects. I don't know how to think about like work from home and quiet quitting that I think are causing sort of a lot of confusion in the way to think about labor. So I think those are all scenario two, very negative. And then scenario one essentially is that fundamentally it's cyclical, like labor is a cyclical dynamic in the economy. And so the Fed is on a mission essentially put people out of work, which is a strange mission, honestly, but it's essentially what they're going to do. And that should really bring down inflation in theory. So I'm going to go scenario two on this one, that basically there's just too much outside their control to be able to do it without some problematic breakage.
Some damage. Yeah, I think the way I would describe the Fed's mission is that it's trying to very carefully thread the needle where right now there's still a lot of job openings. There's a lot of people quitting their jobs to take new jobs that offer more. And I think the Fed is trying to reduce the number of job openings, lower the number of people who are able to quit their job essentially to take better jobs, which is unfortunate. It's a bad way of describing it, but that is what the Fed's trying to do so that it lowers inflation, but without actually getting to the point where we are losing jobs. So it's trying to still get inflation down and ideally in a situation where the labor market is still as healthy as possible. But I also think that it's willing to risk a situation where the labor market does tip over that way if it means getting inflation down. Like it's clear at this point, if you listen to what they're saying and if you look at what they've done in the last 6 months, that inflation is priority one, two, and three, and keeping the job creation going is, you know, lower down the list. And so it's important to remember also that like this stuff can't be done with a lot of precision. I mean, the economy is this huge, unwieldy beast. And so when the Fed's raising rates, that itself is something of a clunky tool. It's not precise, it's not surgical.
Right, so that tees up sort of a category of issues around the Fed's limitations. The Fed's, you know, one tool, but a lot of the things happening in the world related to inflation are sort of outside their control. So let's talk about Europe, broadly speaking, energy and food.
Yeah.
So this is probably an easy one. It tips to scenario two, because Europe is exporting inflation here, and war in Ukraine is exporting inflation everywhere. Shortages, energy, there's nothing good about it.
Yeah, there's nothing good about it. And it's likely that most of the really big, useful responses that the world can make, and which I think the world is making, take some time to actually feed into inflation. So there's been a resurgence of different countries that want to pursue nuclear power again as an alternative. There has been quite a few things that the U.S. has tried, releasing oil from its, you know, stock of reserves. And so I think there are some things that are being pursued, but it takes a long time for those things to actually work out. Certainly the transition to things like electric vehicles and whatnot, that is a longer term path that we're on. And in the meantime, I'm just not sure that there's an obvious immediate solution to the crisis in energy and the crisis in food prices. I think that is just a kind of a thing that we have to live with. Though I would say that, again, if you look at base effects, that is a kind of a one-time shock. I mean, we have to remember that inflation is the rate of price growth remaining the same year after year. And so eventually that does wear off. That does stop contributing to the rate of inflation, but it takes some time. It's just going to take, you know, I think another year or so before that does start to happen, because so much of the activity we've seen in food and energy happened earlier this year. So I'm going to stay with, I guess this is one where scenario one and two kind of converge, because it already was such a negative trend. But I see it as a problem, and I see it as a continuing problem. But prove me wrong, man. Or maybe you're the optimistic one comes to this category.
No, I'm saying it's only a breakage.
Okay.
For a pessimistic thing to cause scenario one to be essentially a positive outcome from a pessimistic dynamic, right? Brings down inflation without causing breakage. And I think Europe is almost going into what was happening in the United States in March 2020, where you have basically like close to a depression because the cost of everything is skyrocketing there. I mean, like literally people having to pay electricity bills of $1,500 a month. People are going into forests to find firewood and just chopping down trees. I mean, it's scary. And that's forcing the government to stimulate like we did in March 2020. So you have this sort of like depressive effects on the economy combined with stimulation, which is inflationary. So it's like deeply stagflationary. Just think everything about that is negative for the United States and for the world. I put it as this is like likely to cause some second order effects that are breaking somewhere.
Yeah, the fracturing of Europe, for example, is a very real risk from the energy crisis.
Right.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, or Putin's able to break Europe's position on Ukraine. So okay, so let's move to one that's not that many more positives here, but here, let's try supply chains.
Okay, yeah.
Scenario one, do they normalize? Or scenario two, do they actually stay structurally inflationary?
Yeah, outside of these big categories that we've described, we have seen some easing in supply chains in terms of shipping rates, trucking rates, freight rates, things like that. I actually do anticipate that will continue, partly because the world has had some time to adapt. This is all contingent on there not being some massive new variant or some other kind of snarling of the supply chains, but they have improved in the last few months. And so I'm somewhat optimistic about this. So I'm gonna go with a firm scenario one on global supply chains, outside of those categories, of course, that we just mentioned.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Finally, we find overlap here. So I think of it like housing or like goods and manufacturing, that it's still in disruption today. If you look, there's still wait times of 90 days outside a lot of ports, when wait times would have been 4 days in 2019. Our home builders we work with are still seeing 75% of the markets they operate in are still supply chain constrained. So I say it's like housing or like goods and manufacturing. It's not here yet, but you can see it coming. And I think it's going to be largely positive in terms of bringing inflation down in a normal way rather than in a sort of a break like what happened in 2008.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with supply chains in particular, some of this just involves a societal learning. This was all as recently as a year or two ago, somewhat new, having to adapt in the aftermath of a pandemic with so many moving parts. You know, how do you adjust to it? And it's the kind of thing, though, that can improve, partly because it was hard to imagine it getting much worse than it was the end of last year or earlier this year. So I am still going to, I hear what you're saying, but I'm gonna stand fast on my optimism on global supply chains. Yeah.
Okay, so let me transition now. There's only a few more left here to asset prices, or what I'd call the wealth effect. So if asset prices are skyrocketing, like what happened in 2007 or 2021, people have a lot more money, they spend a lot more money, that causes inflation. Like in 2006-07, there was a lot of commodity inflation. So that was inflationary. How do you think of the wealth effect? I mean, it seems pretty straightforward, but it's clearly a big driver of inflation.
Yeah, I think it'll contribute to reducing inflation is the short answer. If people eventually start seeing house prices in particular, if they start to decline, I think people really will feel that, partly because the middle class in particular, you know, if they start to feel like their wealth has come down, I think that'll affect their behavior. But of course, this will also potentially affect behavior at the top, because I think something like about half of the country owns some shares in the stock market as well, and it tends to be the better off half, and the stock market has completely collapsed. And will it recover eventually? Sure. Over time, that tends to be what happens. But right now, there's been some considerable pain, and I don't see any obvious outlets. In other words, I don't see any obvious places to put your money right now where you're not taking more risk than people may be comfortable with at the moment. So, yeah, I don't know if that falls under scenario one or scenario two, but do I think it will contribute somewhat to reducing inflation? Yes, I very much do. I think, by the way, that in particular, it's going to have an effect on how businesses make decisions as well, because of course, asset prices coming down means that their cost of capital has gone up. So that also feeds into the economy. And we've seen the effects quite quickly already in terms of asset prices themselves. How quickly it'll feed through, who knows? But I think they will feed through. What do you think?
Yeah, totally agree. And this has been an interesting one because asset prices have been falling since February when the Fed said they should fall. And the Fed's still saying they should fall. And it's surprising to me how many people have been fighting that. And over the summer, there was a kind of a rally. And I looked at it and I said, well, this is a sucker's rally. I don't understand why people are fighting the Fed here. So it's fallen since then. And I think it'll fall more. I expect it to fall essentially until you hit that turning point where the Fed says, okay, I think we're going to moderate. Although inflation will start falling. And I expect as inflation falls from 8 to 7 to 6, that the market will over extrapolate that and start to imagine it'll fall to 2 and sort of rally. So I think there will be a rally at some point when inflation starts to fall, expecting the Fed basically to then ease off and then not imagine it gets stuck at a 4 or 5% interest rate. So I think not going to be surprised for the stock market to rally at some point and then again have to take some of it back as inflation remains higher for longer. We're aligned on this one. This does transition nicely to one about expectations, though. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because there's really a lot of academic debate about what causes inflation. And one of them is expectations, which to me sometimes felt like that didn't make sense to me until I lived it.
Yeah.
And then as I lived it, I saw the leases we were going to sign, CapEx, like the capital investments we'd make in building things, all the people I know running companies. As everybody started getting worried about a downturn, I really saw, if everybody thinks there's going to be inflation, it affects every business decision I make, every consumer decision I make. And if I expect it to come down, there's going to be a downturn. So there's real symmetry there. And so I see why I think expectations have not anchored to high inflation. And I think that's been the only thing that saved us. People seem to get anchored into what they think is normal. I think they got anchored last decade into a thinking that low inflation was normal. And that has persisted.
Maybe the last 4 decades, really.
Maybe 4 decades. 4 decades of it falling. And that was such a strong psychological effect that it kept inflation higher because I think a lot of people kept thinking it would be transitory and didn't take their foot off the gas, which made it hard for the Fed to jawbone inflation down. So I really see expectations being a huge driver now that I understand it firsthand. And I see it being a scenario one. So eventually, this asset effect, I think, has a lot of narrative consequences. Nothing like headlines about the stock market collapsing to really drive down inflation. So I say scenario one, as long as the Fed has been acting rapidly, I think we're not going to move to a world where we think high inflation is normal.
Yeah, I'm going with scenario one as well. And the only thing I'd add is that the fact that inflation expectations have remained so muted, despite the actual high inflation that we've experienced, has lent itself to a lot of different interpretations. One of them is that, people know that there is inflation right now, but they're actually expecting the Fed to engineer a recession. In other words, that low inflation expectations are a sign, number one, that people do believe in the Fed's credibility in a sense, but number two, that they're quite pessimistic on the rest of the economy. And that actually does line up with some of the more recent collapses we've seen in things like consumer sentiment. So expectations involves a lot of psychology. There is, as you said, a lot of debate within economics about just how much actual inflation results from inflation expectations. So I'm going to go with scenario one as well for that.
Okay, so now let's take the sort of obverse position that exists in economics, which is that inflation is and always has been a monetary phenomenon.
Okay.
Right? Which is the economists have hold this opinion that inflation is caused by printing money. Let's just recap. So from 2020 to 2021, the Fed printed $6 trillion. So they increased the money supply by 40%. And lo and behold, we had inflation. And they did it differently than they did in the 2010s because they really let that go into the real economy rather than being stuck as reserves or sterilized, as they call it. And so I think that and the fiscal stimulus, like that's the simplest explanation for the inflation. It's so funny because if you read headlines, Wall Street Journal, they talk about supply chains, they talk about labor, they talk about manufacturing, but they never talk about the fact the Fed printed 40% more money. That could be essentially what's driven inflation. And then you'd say, well, that's they stopped doing that. That's they no longer are doing that. They're actually now talking about destroying money through quantitative tightening, right? They're going to start to sell their assets. And when they sell an asset like treasuries or mortgage-backed securities, they're going to get the money and they're going to destroy it. And so that should actually start bringing inflation down if it's a monetary phenomenon that causes inflation.
Yeah, I want to point out here, though, that if you believe the measures of money supply growth that we have, and I don't entirely, by the way, but even if you do, they showed tremendous growth through last year. This year, money supply growth has been incredibly weak. Something very similar has happened with the deficit, which was blown out in 2020 and 2021. This year, according to the latest CBO projections, the deficit is barely growing at all relative to what it had been doing, you know, historically. Mm-hmm. And so if you think that fiscal and monetary stimulus were massive parts of what happened in 2020 and 2021, and I think they were significant contributors to inflation, then you also have to say, well, but those were a last year story. The this year story is actually quite different and should contribute to inflation coming down. So I'm going to actually categorize that as a scenario one. I don't see it as necessarily leading to any kind of a big breakage. You know, from the standpoint of inflation reduction, I would be hopeful.
I agree. They've clearly switched policies and that should then bring inflation down. But the problem is there's a very delayed reaction between the stimulus and the actual effect on inflation, because the channel by which the monetary supply enters the economy as inflation is through velocity of money. So inflation is money supply times the velocity of money equals inflation. And right. So they increased money supply in 2020 and 2021, but the economy didn't speed up again until 2021 and 2022. And that's when we saw inflation. It's just simply a mathematical equation. And so that's why there was a lag. And then they're bringing the velocity of the economy back down again. That's what they're trying to do with higher rates and quantitative tightening. And that basically will then bring inflation down. So it's super lagging, but it's clearly a huge driver of what's caused inflation to go up.
Yeah, and the final point on this is that a big part of inflation, a big part of velocity, as you mentioned, also depends on how the private sector reacts to what the Fed is doing and to what it expects the Fed to do. The Fed, and this is kind of a misconception that a lot of people have, it directly affects something known as the monetary base. The actual increase or decrease in the money supply actually does depend on how the financial institutions and the private sector react to the Fed's control of the monetary base. And I think it's important to make that distinction, even though it is somewhat technical, because that is what matters for inflation. In other words, activity in the private sector, which the Fed doesn't control directly. It influences it quite a bit, of course, but doesn't control directly. And so there's all kinds of other variables here, which is why I think I don't diminish the importance of money supply increases or decreases, but I do think that there's a lot more to it. I don't buy this idea that it is always and everywhere just a monetary phenomenon, though I think the monetary phenomenon matters.
Yeah, agreed. And it does boggle the mind when you really spend time thinking about that money is just credit and credit is actually money, and that the little dollars you see on your bank statement that you think is money is actually an illusion. That money's not sitting anywhere. It's been lent out into the economy.
Listen, and it's so true. It's not like you and I are in a dorm room somewhere pulling from a bong and making this stuff up. This is how the world works. You can't just ignore the psychology, okay? That everything you just said is a real thing. So, yeah, I agree.
Okay. We haven't talked about scenario three, and I'm going to use sort of the last driver of inflation to sort of bring up some of the scenario three, which I'm going to call broadly drivers is geopolitical.
Okay.
Right. Zoltan Pozsar, who's like a famous, I don't know, Fed thinker, is out there with an argument that inflation is going to be here for us for the long term because we've entered a new world order that's going to put the East and the West an economic war. And that the West basically is the demand side. It's the consumption side of the equation. And the East is the supply side. And what started happening is the East, being Russia and China, using their supply as a weapon to get what they want, which is Ukraine or Taiwan. And I think that is actually long-term inflationary and short-term inflationary. And I think the biggest X factor for forecasting.
Yeah, so I'm going to do a little bit of skepticism here. I followed Zoltan's work. Zoltan, by the way, is at Credit Suisse. He's an absolutely marvelous thinker about money, essentially, about the nature of money, how it works in the U.S. and global economy. Here, I think we're getting onto more speculative territory about the kind of post-dollar world that he describes. We very well might be headed in that direction. But I just want to say that predictions of a post-dollar world have come and gone many times in the past. At some point, those predictions may well be proven true. But I have not yet seen, and I'm waiting for more evidence, that we actually are transitioning into a world where so many countries, significant countries with economies that actually matter for the global economy, are so eager to move away from what has provided such a deep underpinning to their own financial systems and to their own economies, which is, as of right now, the dollar as the global reserve currency. Nothing lasts forever, okay? But I am not yet sold on this particular prediction of Zoltan. So I'm going to go ahead and say that in terms of geopolitics in the short term, I'm going to say scenario one, but that's actually one where weirdly I would even go with scenario three.
Yeah, scenario three.
To hit you with a curveball. Right. I would just say scenario three is the realm of geopolitics, which is the anything can go scenario. So I'm not saying that Zoltan's definitely going to be wrong. I'm just saying I'm not super invested in his being right about this particular thing.
Right. I think it's scenario three. If it's anything, it's scenario three, because the point of scenario three is to prepare the mind. Currently in the forecasts of most financial institutions, it's just too uncertain for them to really price it well. So the one I'm imagining is at some point in the next 6 months, we see a headline in the Wall Street Journal that says, government of China, CCP has told the state-owned enterprises to shed their assets in the West. And they start to divest Western assets, treasuries and skyscrapers and bridges, because they basically see that that's keeps them captive. Because when Russia invaded Ukraine, the West seized all the assets of Russia. And that circumscribes the ability of the government to have as much choice as they want. And I think it's hard for a lot of people who are in the economic world to see that many decisions are not economic. Invading Ukraine or trying to take Taiwan is not an economic decision. And I think that's where economics really falls down. And so I could see something like that playing out, and that would be extremely depressionary, because essentially it's like quantitative tightening. As those Western assets get sold, those dollars go back to China and they leave the world economy in a sense. So it's like it's reducing the money supply. At the same time, it's probably inflationary, because a lot of the companies that manufacture in China and Taiwan will have to start manufacturing somewhere else, and that's going to be really expensive. And so that to me is like probably the biggest risk to the world today. Basically, China deciding to take a whole different approach to their engagement with the West.
Yeah, that could well be. I saw something kind of interesting recently, which is that actually as a share of treasuries outstanding, Chinese ownership of those treasuries has actually been coming down for the better part of a decade now. And so the fallout of that wouldn't be quite as bad as what people think. But also, it raises the question of what China's going to do with its abundant reserves in the first place. And it's not actually clear that it has many better options or that there would be a shortage of buyers for treasuries if China does stop. So I guess on that particular channel, I'm not super worried. I'm more worried about other things that you described, right? Like other things that affect real economic activity, like what's happened between Russia and Ukraine. And so I'm more worried about a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, for example, and what the fallout could be, which I don't pretend to know. But I'm more worried about that and how it would harm real economic activity than I am about these more kind of, frankly, for now, still abstract worries about what might happen if some of the world starts shifting demand away from the dollar or from U.S. treasuries, which I'm not even entirely convinced would be necessarily a negative for the U.S. economy. But yeah, I'm happy to stick in that one as our one category three driver of future inflation.
Yeah.
And saying wide open.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you replace the dollar with something else. I'm just saying that it's really a whole different dynamic I'm talking about. So
yeah.
Now let's reflect on what we just went through and look for a few patterns maybe that would help us look at decision-making in the coming months. So based on that, do you tally it up and saying there seems to be more scenario two than scenario one? Is it a tight call still?
It's a close race. It's just that right now, scenario one more closely resembles scenario two than it did even 6 months ago when we last spoke, right?
Convergence.
There's a certain amount of convergence between those two scenarios. I will say this, that I'm definitely more pessimistic about U.S. economic growth and the likelihood that we'll be able to keep growing than I certainly was, 6 months ago. And I think my main takeaway of having revisited the scenario planning, which I'm really glad we did, is that the world is so different than it was back then. I mean, we were worried about such different things. We were worried about the Omicron variant starting to spin off and getting more people. We were still incredibly worried about supply chains. It turned out that supply chains eased up, but the outcome of Ukraine-Russia was different from what we thought it would be. We didn't imagine that the Fed would jack up interest rates by 300 basis points in that small amount of time since we spoke, or that Jerome Powell would shift his language so much away from what it had been in the past, which was such a deep emphasis on well-being, on the labor market, on people having jobs and their lives, and almost entirely now focusing on inflation, as you said, which I agree with you, is the big driver. And so, that combined with inflation being where it is just a great reminder that it will be quite different from what we anticipate 6 months from now. I think that to me might be the single most useful thing of this exercise. It's an exercise essentially in humility and in really trying to think clearly about what could happen.
So I think I was pessimistic in February and March. We wrote an investor letter in January saying we thought the credit market had it wrong. And I'm starting to get, not optimistic, I'm starting to see it to tip. And I can see it tipping to the positive over the next 3 to 6 months. But let me just roll back and look at the sort of actions we took. So around March, we started under the view that we thought it'd get worse and it would be higher for longer. We started to prepare. So here's the things we did, right? So we slowed down investing. So we raised a lot of capital every month. And basically, we started to not deploy it and build up cash. Because what we were seeing on the ground was portfolios of real estate would come to market. And they would trade at a 3.9 cap or high threes, which basically that's the kind of price you'd pay if things were really optimistic. And we basically passed and missed because we were bidding much higher cap rates or lower prices all through March, April, May, June, July. Even 2 weeks ago, 1,000 homes went to market and we were floored to still see cap rates or still see prices to be optimistic. And one of the strange things we've seen when we go out to tech conferences or real estate conferences, everybody sits around saying it was really bad, but basically we're through the worst of it. And this, within 12 months, things will be good again. That expectation, normally the market's reflexive. So if people think something, the market then will price that in and then it ends up being sort of self-fulfillingly wrong. So that's one thing we did is we slowed down. We built liquidity on the platform in preparation for the market going down more. And so we're now waiting for the market to bottom, which you can't know when it's going to be the bottom, but you have to have a view that it's going to get better from here. And I think it gets worse from here. And we fixed as much debt as we could fix the rate of debt. So what can you invest in? We found a couple interesting places to invest. So we used to buy mostly equity. We used to buy residential. Now we actually started lending to it. And the credit markets has been really more attractive. So you could think of cap rates and yields as the same. So you buy an apartment building at a 4, you can lend like mezzanine debt at a 7, 8, 9, 10. So you're like the lender at 70% of value at a much higher rate than the equity. So that was like something we did and we've been doing. And I think we're going to do more of. And then sort of in broadly speaking, right, rental housing and industrial, which is what almost 100% of our portfolio is made of, is a basic need. And so it does much better in the downturn than like office or hotels or retail. And so anyways, so we've been fairly concerned for some time. And so we went into it looking at that. But actually, I'm starting to get optimistic because I feel like within 6 months, there's going to be a market bottom. You know, you'll know it's the bottom when people think inflation and interest rates will be high forever.
Yeah. And I would surface something also that you said in that early conversation, which is that a lot of your investors who obviously have other investments in their portfolio had in 2020 and 2021 made 30-40% on equities. And some of them had asked you like, hey, why aren't you Fundrise giving me that kind of a big return? And you'd had to kind of explain to them, well, the value of what we do also makes itself known in a downturn specifically. And so it's interesting to hear you say that, even beyond just shifting the mix from buying to lending, to hear that you're positioning yourself now, I guess, for an entry point into this market relatively soon, I guess in part because asset prices have fallen by so much and also because you see the opportunity now.
Yeah, it's a challenge because you really have to be early. You can't be late on these types of things. Every asset has basically gone down this year. Cash has gone down at the rate of inflation, which is 8%, and bonds have gone down 15%, and stocks, I think, will be down 30-40% by the end of the year. So we've definitely outperformed on a relative basis everything, but I don't think we're through the worst of it yet. And so it's really about, both scenario one and scenario two converging, or mostly converging around a negative dynamic for some time to come. It seems like we have to traverse through the dark forest for a little bit longer.
Yeah, absolutely. How does this affect your thinking on your new tech fund relative to how you're thinking about real estate?
It's the same dynamic, which is you go slow. You don't deploy in the short term, except for in places where you feel like you have a good margin of safety. A lot of times with private tech, when you invest in a private tech company, you're not buying common shares. You're buying preferred. And preferred shares are like a debt instrument. They're like participating debt structure. So a lot of the headlines we see company raising at some big valuation, $5 billion, that's not really a true valuation because those venture funds didn't buy common. They bought preferred with a participation over a $5 billion rate, over a hurdle. So my personal forecast going forward, we basically are looking for signal of a shift. I think we're close to it. Like I'm saying 6 months. By the time we do this 6 months from now, we'll see it. What's ironic is that even something really bad, like a tactical nuclear weapon on the ground of Ukraine, which is horrible, means the Fed has to stop raising rates. So it's like this perverse situation where the world's waiting for bad news in order to basically see the end of rate hikes. And that bad news might be a recession. It might be, you know, the stock market collapse, some sort of market collapse. But basically, you either need a slow or sudden break. And that's the difference between scenario one and scenario two, just how fast it takes to bring things down. And that's, again, pessimistic. And then at that point, whether it happens slowly or quickly, that's when you pivot to an aggressive stance. So it's at the bottom. So that's emotionally sort of counterintuitive, but it's hard in that situation. Like in March 2020, when everything was going bad, how many people were buying stock? It's not easy to sort of overcome that feeling. I know we were struggling. I was very worried at that time. I think that kind of situation may come in 2023.
All right. I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. Thanks to listeners for subscribing and tell everybody about it. And yeah, Ben, we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Great. Thanks, Cardiff.
You have been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, featuring Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. My name is Cardiff Garcia of Bizarre Audio. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. This podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, which also did our music. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode.